Hello to everyone, and welcome to the very last teleclass in the 2006 schedule, Clostridium difficile update. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague and the co-founder of Teleclass Education, Dr. Syed Tatar, let me say that we are absolutely delighted that you are able to join us today. In the last 3 years, we have rounded up our teleclass schedules in spectacular style and to great acclaim because in each of the last 3 years, our faculty for the final teleclass of the year has been Dr. Michelle Alpha. Dr. Alpha is the director of the Microbiology Laboratory for St. Boniface Hospital in Winnipeg. She is a regular on the speakers rosters for CHICA, APIC, and SHEA meetings. She does some really cool and some very practical research, and she has the passion and the enthusiasm of the very best of teachers. She's also one of my very favorite teleclass faculty. Before Michelle begins, let me say a word of thanks to Arjo for their sponsorship of this teleclass. As a policy, we don't advertise or endorse any company during teleclasses, but I will say that the folk at Arjo have been very good to me. And they have had a really very global impact on infection control education, and I'm very grateful to them. Lisa Coot et al., thank you very much. Now, to give the teleclass lecture, Clostridium difficile update from beautiful Winnipeg, Manitoba, I am honored and delighted and pleased to present my friend, Dr. Michelle Alpha. Michelle.
Thank you, Paul. And after that kind of an introduction, there's no way I'm going to live up to anybody's expectations. So bear with me as we go through what is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart, and I'm sure to many of you as well. Near and dear might not be the right term. Maybe the frustration of the moment and one of the very topical issues. When I agreed to give this presentation, probably almost a year ago, I had glibly thought that there might be something interesting about C. difficile that we could touch bases on, and so I simply entitled it C. difficile Update. As I went through some of the projects that we were working on, I thought that one of the things that might be very interesting might be to provide some information and also, I hope, stimulate some thoughts and some discussion and questions on the issue of Clostridium difficile in the environment and what are the impacts of this organism within the healthcare setting. So I ask for your understanding as we go through it. There are many unknowns and I think there's many controversial areas, but I'm hoping that by the time I'm finished this teleclass, I will have stimulated at least one or two new thoughts in your mind and hopefully provided you with some insight into some of the issues around C. difficile in the environment. So if you can go on to the second slide, which is basically an overview of what I would like to discuss today, the first item I want to touch on is Clostridium difficile itself and the unique characteristics of this organism that provide some unique challenges to us in the healthcare environment. The second issue is what does that mean in terms of environmental issues for C. difficile? I have to tell you, I've never ceased to be amazed at this particular pathogen, and as we learn more about it, it has a very, very unique pathogenesis and a very, very unique means of causing human infection, and the environmental aspect is one of those, and we're going to try to focus on that today. Of course, I'm then going to touch bases on our favorite topic, which are toilets, commodes, and bedpans, and share with you some of the delightful and not so delightful things that we have discovered as we started looking at these as potential reservoirs within the healthcare environment. And finally, what I'd like to do is touch on bedpan washers and raise for discussion, I think, some of the issues that have not been, in my opinion, fully addressed. And I would like to share with you some of the data that we have recently gathered and present some information regarding issues around bedpan washers and their efficacy with respect to C. difficile. So if you can go on to the next slide, the third slide is really a picture that shows the pseudomembranes that are present in someone with full-blown C. difficile-associated diarrhea. Now, as all of you probably are already aware, this disease is actually a multi-hit disease. It is not one that just because the organism is present, are you sure that the patient has C. difficile-associated diarrhea? It is multi-hit in that it requires the presence of a toxigenic Clostridium difficile, and there are many C. difficile strains that do not carry the genes for producing toxin and therefore do not cause this infection. So the organism that needs to be present is actually the strain or a strain that produces toxins and can lead to the disease. The second hit that is needed almost invariably is an imbalance in the normal gastrointestinal flora. And most frequently, we see this happening when patients are given antimicrobials for other reasons that leads to the imbalance in the flora. And if there's a toxigenic C. diff there, it can then obviously proliferate and produce its toxins that cause the disease. And the third aspect that needs to be taken into consideration are the host factors. There is some evidence that people may have some immunity or higher degree of resistance to infection with this organism depending on a variety of host factors. The other aspect of it is that there is a wide range in terms of the clinical manifestations for this disease. They range all the way from asymptomatic carriage through diarrhea and colitis, which are essentially inflammatory processes in the mucosa of the bowel, all the way to the other end, which is the very nasty end of C. diff disease, and that's where you get PMC, or pseudomembranous colitis. And that's what's shown in the picture that's on this diagram as well. And the black arrow that's there is actually pointing to a white patch, and that's one of the pseudomembranes. And you can see that the surface of this mucosa, of this gut, is absolutely covered in those white patches, and every one of those represent a necrotic invasive process of the gut mucosa produced by Clostridium difficile and its toxins. Now, if this is left or not treated effectively in a reasonable period of time, it can lead to toxic megacolon, and that can ultimately result in perforation of the bowel, which, of course, is quite disastrous. And when people get toxic megacolon, it's essentially a surgical emergency requiring them to urgently go in and cut out the portions of the bowel that are affected by this disease. So we can see here that C. diff-associated disease in and of itself is an interesting disease because it is multi-hit, and the disease ranges all the way from asymptomatic carriage up to life-threatening toxic megacolon. If you go to the next slide, you are now looking at the face of C. difficile, and what I would like to point out is there are purplish rod-shaped organisms, and there's an arrow at the top of your slide that will be pointing to one of those. And this is the representative vegetative form. Now, C. difficile is an anaerobe, and it is unique in that it produces spores in addition to the vegetative form. The vegetative form is a metabolically active form of C. difficile. What does that mean? It means that it is able to produce the toxins, that if it has the genes for them, it's the metabolically active form that will produce these toxins. And the ones that are produced are toxins A and B, and there may be some others like binary toxin that we'll learn more about as we get more data published. Now, the metabolically active vegetative form is killed by some antibiotics. So, for instance, if a person had C. diff-associated diarrhea, they would often be treated with either metronidazole or vancomycin because those two antibiotics are effective against the vegetative form of C. difficile. There are many other antibiotics that this organism is almost intrinsically resistant to, often the fluoroquinolones, clindamycin, and a number of others that when other antibiotics are used that kill off the GI flora, they don't touch C. diff, and it becomes like an open petri dish saying, replicate and do your thing. So remember that it's almost a dyslexic or oxymoron type of relationship. Treatment with some antibiotics upsets the bowel flora and actually can facilitate one of the hits that can lead to C. diff diarrhea. And yet, on the other hand, in order to treat this organism, you often do need to give specific antibiotics directed or targeted to C. difficile itself. Now, oxygen exposure kills the vegetative form because it is a strict anaerobe and it cannot survive in the anaerobic environment. That killing doesn't happen instantaneously, and it's under pressure, like exposure to oxygen or lack of nutrition, that it will form its second form, which is shown by the other two arrows near the bottom of the picture, and this is the spore form. Now, you'll notice one of the organisms that I've put an arrow to has a long rod-shaped organism with a subterminal white circle, which is the spore. And you'll see the other one that I've arrowed is an actual spore all by itself. It's lost the vegetative component of it. Because what happens is the healthy anaerobic C. difficile stains as a gram-positive rod, and as it goes into its spore form, of course, it will become very refractile to staining, and you can see those two examples in this picture. Now, interestingly, the spore is not metabolically active at all, and what this means is the spore form does not produce toxins at all. So if you put two and two together, you'll realize that what is causing the disease in humans is not the spore form of the organism, it's the vegetative form that's pumping out toxins because it's metabolically active. The spore form is not touched by any antibiotics. Metronidazole nor vancomycin have any effect on the spore form of C. difficile. And that leads you to a better understanding why patients often have recurrences or relapses of this disease, because if you think about it, if you treat them with metronidazole or vancomycin for 10 to 14 days and you haven't allowed the normal gastrointestinal flora to reestablish itself, yes, the vegetative form of C. diff is killed, but the spore form may still be around in the gut. When you stop the antibiotics, metro or vancomycin, any of the spore forms, if there isn't competing normal flora in the gastrointestinal tract available to keep them under control, the spore forms will now grow out, they become metabolically active, start pumping out toxin, and the patient gets a recurrence of their diarrhea. So again, a unique characteristic of the spores is they are not affected by antibiotics. And of course, the other interesting point is that oxygen exposure doesn't kill them either. And in fact, if you have fecal material on a surface somewhere that has C. diff spores on it, those spores can actually survive for years in that dry environment because they're resistant to oxygen, they're resistant to drying. It's like a seed that germinates. When you put it back into an environment that it likes, for instance, if somebody touches the surface of a toilet or a handle and then puts their finger in their mouth and the spore then is ingested, it's now going into the GI tract, which it loves, and that spore will then grow out and become a vegetative form if the conditions are suitable for it to do that. So this is the beast, and I've already gone over a number of features of it that indicate that it is a very unique microorganism, and one of the interesting and few spore formers that really can cause significant human infection. If you go on to the next slide, one of the interesting areas that I think is we fail to recognize that in patients that have C. diff-associated diarrhea, and forgive me, I'm a microbiologist, so on this slide you'll see a container with fecal material in it from somebody who actually has C. difficile, and you'll notice that it's very watery and takes the shape of the container. In the good old days, and I'm old enough to remember the good old days, we used to actually culture the stool to detect C. difficile, and then we'd have to test to see if it was toxigenic and then send our report out. Well, the traditional method for culturing for C. diff from stool samples is to either alcohol shock with 95% alcohol or heat shock the stool sample. And essentially what that process does is it kills all the vegetative organisms, all of the bacteria, including C. difficile vegetative organisms, and only organisms that are in a spore form can actually survive that type of treatment. What you would then do is, after the heat or alcohol treatment, it would get planted onto an agar media, which is incubated anaerobically. And in the slide I'm showing you, I've shown the example of CDMN agar plates, and you can see the C. difficile organism growing on it. Now, what does this tell us? This tells us that the fecal material from patients with C. diff definitely have spores in them. And I think that's a very important point that I want to emphasize, because a lot of what we talk about in the environment stems from the fact that if you were thinking that the stool only had the vegetative form because that's what's causing the disease, and yes, the majority of organisms in that stool sample would be in the vegetative form, I think it's important to not forget the fact that there are also spores right from the time we get those stools from the patient. You can see we don't usually have any difficulty growing C. diff out after we've alcohol shocked or heat shocked, and the reason for that is because there certainly are sufficient stool spores present to survive that treatment and grow out afterwards. Now, if you go to the next slide, what is the impact of those characteristics of the spores? And I want to touch bases on three of them because I think they're important and they raise different questions. The first one is the fact that our alcohol hand hygiene is obviously not going to be effective. I've just told you that you can take 95% alcohol and alcohol shock stool and the C. diff spores will survive. This is the basis for why CDC recommends using soap and water for hand hygiene and not relying solely on the alcohol or the waterless hand wash systems. Now, keep in mind, the alcohol does kill the vegetative form of C. difficile. It just does not kill the spores. Now, we know from the previous slide that the stool material that patients are excreting does have both vegetative and spore forms in it. And therefore, it's important that people using hand hygiene for patients that are on isolation precautions with this particular organism, you can use the waterless or the alcohol-based hand wash systems because it will kill the other vegetative organisms that we want to ensure are not on your hands. It will kill the C. diff vegetative forms as well, but you have to realize that after that, it is important that the hands do get regular washing with soap and water because the spores will not be killed by that alcohol treatment. The second part of it is heat treatment, thermal decontamination. We usually use this to make an item safe to handle and safe for the next patient use. And we're going to talk about bedpans a little later on. But any item that might have come into contact with C. difficile in the stool of a patient, this has an impact on. So thermal treatment can be used, but we're going to find out that there are some unique characteristics about C. diff spores. Again, I've just told you that when we process stools, we use heat treatment as one of the alternatives to kill vegetative forms and to allow us to detect more readily the spores that will then grow out when we culture it. So it tells you right away that obviously it's going to take specific thermal levels in order to kill these spores effectively. And then the third aspect is disinfectant treatment. It often needs substantial time, contact time, in order for the liquid disinfectants to actually kill spores. And we're finding that this is very formulation dependent. In addition to the concentration of the active ingredient, it's also very dependent on the formulation that's used for the particular disinfectant that's being used to treat either surfaces or medical devices, and whether or not this liquid chemical will be effective against the C. diff spores. So if you move on to the next slide, I want to throw this one in here because I think this is an excellent document and I've included it in the list of references at the end of this presentation. It's actually an extract of some of the key things from the Provincial Infectious Disease Advisory Committee, or the PIDAC as they're called. This is a group in Ontario that has prepared some excellent guidance documents, and this particular one is basically dealing with C. difficile in all healthcare settings. So for sure, for healthcare facilities in Canada, I think if you don't have this document, you probably do want to get a hold of it because it has some excellent down-to-earth recommendations for how to deal with C. diff in the environment. Now, of course, one of the first things that comes out is that we recognize that patients with this infection really need to be put on isolation precautions. So in addition to routine practices, that means also contact precautions. And patients in those rooms, some of the controversial issues obviously rotate around how quickly can you take them off of contact or isolation precautions, because it is difficult for the patient when they're in isolation. Life is not very pleasant. But it's also important to recognize you don't want to take them off of isolation precautions too early and then put other patients at risk as they get admitted to that room of acquiring C. difficile because the patient was taken off of isolation precautions too early. The second bullet is, of course, the hand hygiene issue, and we've already touched on that, the use of soap and water. The other recommendation that comes is for room cleaning, and the recommendation from the PIDAC guidance document is that it should be done twice per day. Routinely in healthcare facilities, we strive to get it done once per day, and sometimes even that can be a challenge. But the recommendations for most guidance documents dealing with C. diff would indicate that patients on isolation precautions, the room cleaning should be done twice per day. It also suggests that if you're experiencing an outbreak and there's ongoing transmission, you may want to consider hypochlorite after routine cleaning as a mechanism to try to interfere with that. And I'm going to present some data today and discuss this concept. And then again, after 48 hours without diarrhea, this is for patients that have obviously been treated, you may stop isolation precautions, but the recommendation is you should not do it earlier than that. And finally, that there should be no test of cure done on these patients. So if the diagnostic test shows they have C. diff diarrhea, the clinician has decided that they get therapy for it, there is little value in taking a stool sample, you know, at the end of their therapy or during their therapy to send it to the lab to see whether or not it's positive for C. diff toxin, because the stool of the patients that have this tend to shed it for fairly long periods of time. And so a test of cure is often very misleading and is not recommended for patients with C. diff associated diarrhea. Now, if you move to the next slide, environmental reservoirs of C. diff are kind of the focus that I would like to look at today. And if you look at the current guidelines that are available from Health Canada, the recommendation is that environmental cleaning in healthcare should be done with regular detergent, and for the most part, there's no need to use disinfectants, and that the emphasis should be on physical action. The PIDAC guidance document in Ontario recommends considering hypochlorite if there's ongoing transmission of CDAD. And then the other issue is bedpans we know will have spores in them when they're used on patients that have this infection. And the question is, what type of thermal treatment is appropriate for bedpans used on patients on isolation precautions with this infection? Now, one of the interesting documents that is out there is the ISO guidance document 15883, and they were recently approved for a publication, and the recommendation there is that the minimum thermal treatment should be 80 degrees centigrade for 1 minute, the concept being that that is a sufficient thermal treatment to kill most organisms. Now, in that ISO document, they do indicate that you need to take into consideration the organisms that may be present in the medical devices being thermally treated, but there is no reference to C. diff and no reference to the concept of whether these would be sufficient thermal conditions for patients with this type of infection. And then, of course, there's steam sterilization, which we know is effective because it is a sporicidal process. So if you go to the next slide, and I've shown a picture here of actually one of the toilets in our facility, and what I'd like you to notice is this is one of the ones that has those notorious bedpan sprayers. You can see the black hose hanging up on the wall behind the toilet, and you can see what is probably a bell cord pull that is hanging down there as well. Now, what I want to focus on at this point is the issues around the reservoir in the toilet facilities. There is no lack of published information indicating that there is a high frequency of spores in the toilet environment for patients that have C. diff-associated diarrhea. What is interesting and somewhat controversial is the role that using bleach as an environmental disinfectant has on these spores in the toilet environment. Now, under item number one, bleach has been accepted as an effective intervention, but I want to point out that 500 parts per million to 1,000 parts per million are not really very effective against C. diff spores. They're not effective against many types of spores. And the concentration that's needed to really be effective is 5,000 parts per million. And I'm saying this in the context of an environmental cleaning agent, a cleaning and disinfectant agent, where the contact time is not going to be very long. So please keep that in mind when I'm saying this. The higher 5,000 parts per million of bleach is needed because of the fact that the contact time is actually relatively short. If we look at the publication, Wilcox in 2005 did publish a paper showing that if you have suboptimal concentrations of cleaners and disinfectants, that in fact these may stimulate spore production. In short, if you take fecal material and there's some left in the toilet and there's only a small amount of the residual cleaner or disinfectant there, or if people are using reusable toilet brushes and the toilet brush has spores on it that are left in a suboptimal concentration of disinfectant, disinfectant. What Wilcox showed was that actually the vegetative forms are more prone to stimulate and go into the spore form. And that's probably because the suboptimal concentration can't kill the vegetative form, and therefore it's being stressed and is rapidly, as it's gasping its last breath, frantically trying to convert into the spore form. And so suboptimal concentrations actually stimulate spore production. The other study that's been widely quoted is Wilcox's study in the Journal of Hospital Infection of 2003, and they used 1,000 parts per million as an environmental agent, and they concluded that bleach was effective. And this is one of the published studies that many people refer to supporting the fact that bleach should be used when you have C. diff as an issue. But if you look at the data that's presented in this paper, the data did not show any difference in environmental load of spores, none whatsoever. What they showed was a difference in the incidence of C. diff disease on Ward A compared to Ward B, Ward A being where they were using bleach and Ward B where they were using their routine agent. But it's interesting, when they did the swap over and used bleach on Ward B and their routine agent on Ward A, they did not show a reduction in the incidence of CDAD. And certainly the data that they published from both arms of that study showed that the spore levels were essentially the same when they did test in the environment. So although this is a highly referred to article, in actuality, the hardness of the data to support that bleach will reduce the load of spores in the environment is not totally solid, in my opinion. And part of the reason may be that there's no way in that study they were able to show that the bleach was actually effectively used on the toilets that they were sampling. So in conclusion, in reality, the bleach is effective against C. diff spores. If you do lab testing, and we've done these, with 5,000 parts per million, it can kill C. diff spores lickety-split. Within 1 to 2 minutes, it will eradicate them. In the healthcare environment, though, you've got to remember that there's fecal and organic material present, and the contact time is very low, and if you're not using 5,000 parts per million bleach, you don't get as effective kill. Now, bleach at 5,000 parts per million also generates a lot of fumes and is truly a workplace hazard. It's very difficult for people to work with this and to use it in healthcare facilities or any other facility for that matter. And certainly there are workplace hazard issues related to this. So the goal would be obviously to try to find something that will give you good C. diff spore kill but not have the workplace hazards that the bleach does. If you move to the next slide, just to summarize some of what we know about bleach and its use in the healthcare environment, certainly bleach was used in the Quebec outbreak, and certainly the workplace safety issues were raised, but it was thought to be helpful in the curtailment and the stopping of some of the spread of C. diff-associated diarrhea in the healthcare facilities in Quebec. However, again, it's very controversial in the sense that many of the people who had to use this obviously were not happy using it because of the workplace safety issues. The published data that's out there, as I've just alluded to, is not totally convincing because the data on the C. diff spores themselves in the environment is not convincing. It doesn't support the conclusions. And there was a recent study by Tomizek in Healthcare Quarterly in 2006 that suggested they looked at it and they tried bleach and they found that their staff were having a terrible time dealing with it, and they opted not to use it but to try to focus on their housekeeping, focus on their actual cleaning, the physical actual cleaning. And they used an alternative. They used a hydrogen peroxide-based compound, not bleach, but they also changed a number of parameters as well. They basically, in my opinion, took an excellent approach, multitasking, but they focused on improving their housekeeping, giving value to the people doing the cleaning, ensuring that they knew that it was important that they did a good job and the repercussions of what would happen if they didn't. And they found they were able to control an outbreak without the use of bleach. So I present to you what I hope is a reasonably balanced approach to the information that we have for bleach, and I hope I've indicated to you that bleach works, but it's not the be-all and the end-all in terms of C. diff outbreak control, and that is possible there are other components that would work. If we go to the next slide, one of the other liquid chemical agents that has been evaluated in terms of its efficacy against Clostridium difficile spores is the accelerated hydrogen peroxide compounds. And certainly the 7% formulation at 10 minutes of exposure has been shown to have effective killing ability against C. diff spores. But it's very formulation dependent, and you'll notice the contact time is 10 minutes. And what I'd like to point out is that at 7%, the manufacturer recommends that, of course, your personal protective equipment is absolutely mandatory, and that means gloves, masks, protective things, because at 7% there's certainly fumes that will be generated and the potential for difficulty in handling this when you're using it on an environmental surface. I can tell you from our perspective that we did some studies and looked at putting some of these compounds onto toilet seats and letting it sit until it had completely dried. And some of the very strong formulations of hydrogen peroxide can actually eat up the finish on the toilet. So obviously, you know, you have to put into context that what's published in the literature about the efficacy of a liquid disinfectant, you must also take into consideration whether it's formulated for use as an environmental surface cleaner, disinfector, or whether it's formulated for use for medical device disinfection, and the contact time, whether it can be achieved for a surface disinfectant agent versus when you're soaking instruments in it. 10 minutes is actually not a very long period of time, but in the time studies we've done watching housekeeping staff, on average the contact time to the liquid, for instance on a toilet seat, might be in the magnitude of 3 minutes if you're fortunate. Now, the other thing would be, what is the optimal formulation for accelerated hydrogen peroxide compounds? There's some very exciting work that's being done, and I'm sure there'll be future publications that will come out that we will see some formulations that have good C. difficile spore killing ability, and they're formulated in a way to facilitate use for surface disinfection. And I look forward to, there may be other types of active ingredients that will, with specific formulation, also be able to do this. Now, the workplace safety concerns I've already indicated, and obviously what we would prefer is a formulation that does not have those safety concerns. And I've given the reference there to the study that was published in Healthcare Quarterly where they used an accelerated hydrogen peroxide compound for their surface disinfection rather than bleach, and were effective in combination with other interventions in controlling the outbreak. Now, if you can go to the next slide, I love this picture because it kind of, I don't know, it's the nightmare of what we have to deal with. The toilets, commodes, and the bedpans. What to do. And, you know, I don't know that I really have answers for all of these things, but I think I would like to raise some of the issues that I think we all need to put some time to think to. Now, the first picture on the left, in many washroom facilities and healthcare, the sluice or the sprayer still exists, and many centers still have these. And the sprayer that's shown there often have almost like a handle mechanism that will release the high-pressure water that's used to rinse bedpans into a toilet or into a sluice. And it doesn't take rocket science to recognize that if you're using like a spray gun approach, you're blasting spores into the environment all over the place. And, of course, the issues of aerosolization of fecal material, even if you can't see visible fecal material on the floor or the walls or the toilet seat, the reality is that the microbes may still be there and the spores could certainly be there. So if there's one message I would like to leave you with, it's that when you have patients with C. diff-associated diarrhea and they're on isolation precautions, I think the use of these bedpan sprayers is really not a good thing because it certainly leads to aerosolization of any of the organisms that are in the bedpan. But of course, we know if the spores are there, they're going to end up in the environment and they're going to survive for very long periods of time. So sprayers, that's a real concern. The middle picture that I've shown is actually a commode, and I've renamed it. I don't think they're commodes anymore. I think they become C. diff mobiles when they're used on patients that have C. difficile-associated diarrhea. And the reason I say that is when we were doing a study, we found that we were taking samples from the commodes, and it turned out that when people got to go, they got to go. And what often happens is the commodes will go from one room to the other, and we found that in a lot of the patients that were on C. diff isolation precautions and they were using a commode, often their commode was urgently needed and it was whipped out and used in another patient's room, which, as we all know, is really not a good thing to do, because if someone has C. diff-associated diarrhea, all the type of devices or equipment should be dedicated to that patient and not used on another patient, and they required cleaning and disinfection before they're used on another patient. The other thing that we found out in our healthcare facility, which was really quite shocking, was that the commodes were in no man's land. The nursing staff thought that the housekeeping staff was responsible for cleaning and disinfecting the commodes, and the housekeeping staff thought that the nursing staff, when they put the patient on the commode, were responsible for emptying and cleaning and disinfecting it. And when we started our pilot study that we did about a year and a half ago, we found out that nobody was actually cleaning and disinfecting the commodes, and that the research technologist came to me one day and she said, you know, I think we have to do something. She said, I can't keep going back up to these toilets, these commodes. She said, I don't need any science or data to tell me they're not being cleaned. She said, I can see gobs of fecal material that have been on the toilet lid for days on end. And when we finished our pilot study, that was one of the things that changed. The infection control department very efficiently made sure that it became the responsibility of a specific group of people, and that was put in our policies and procedures. The picture on the far right is an example of bedpans. And the issue of plastic or stainless steel bedpans, I know in Europe, stainless steel, I think, tends to be used predominantly, whereas in North America, pretty much the vast majority of sites are actually using plastic bedpans. And the issue of what do you do with the bedpan on an incontinent or a patient that cannot walk to the toilet facilities or cannot get on the commode, and do you need to dispose of the waste? And that's where the question about bedpan washers comes in for discussion. In the past, of course, the bedpans would have been trotted into the sprayer and the contents dumped down the sluice or the toilet and then sprayed with the sprayer to clean them. And then likely that bedpan would have been leaned somewhere in the bathroom facility to dry. And shock of shocks, our research technologist even noticed that some of the bedpans were put back in the little cupboard that the patients ate their meals off of. And of course, these bedpans had not had any degree of disinfection at all. They basically had been rinsed. So I think that the advent and the use of ward bedpan washers certainly has gone a long way to helping with these issues, reducing aerosolization, reducing contact to the caregivers, and ensuring that appropriate disposal of the material from bedpans is actually effected. If you can go to the next slide, one of the other questions that comes up, and I couldn't find a nice picture that had a bedpan in it, so I've got a fellow with a toilet, but the questions I'm raising are to do with bedpan reprocessing. If it is used by a patient, who empties and cleans the bedpan? And I suggest that you think about who does that in your facility and don't assume because you have a policy that it's actually being done. The second question is the bedpan just rinsed with water? And you'd be surprised to find, I think, in many instances, how frequently that sometimes can happen. And where does the bedpan get stored? I've alluded to the fact that sometimes it can be put in the bathroom facility to dry, or sometimes it's stuck in a little cabinet beside the patient. But these are all things, I think, that do need to be looked at and incorporated into the procedures and policies that healthcare facilities have. And then after a C. difficile-associated disease patient is discharged, does the bedpan go to the central processing department for reprocessing and or sterilization? And I think that's an important consideration that does need to be looked at. If you go to the next slide, what I'd like to touch now on are the ward bedpan washer versus the sprayer and sluice. And I've already given you my bias that I feel that the aerosols created by the sprayer and sluice are a major problem, and that we really need to reduce that approach to dealing with bedpans. Now, is the bedpan wash cycle adequate to eliminate C. diff? Serendipitously, we did some studies here in our hospital, and what we did was, you can see the picture on the left where we did a mock inoculation of a circle on a bedpan with a number of spores in fecal material. This was dried overnight, and then we determined the residual viable spores by sampling with a Rodac plate, which there is a picture of shown in that slide. Then what we did was we looked at whether the bedpan, if it was processed through a Ward bedpan washer, would, number one, be visibly clean, and number two, were there any detectable spores remaining. So if you go to the next slide, this is some data from the study that we did, and all these tests were done in triplicate, so I haven't shown the error bars, but they're very tight. Now, our current standard is that bedpans should be visibly clean, and the bedpan washers certainly do meet that criteria. The Rodac sampling of the bedpans post-cycle did indicate that there were difficulties with the current thermal cycles in many of the bedpan washers to actually kill C. diff spores. So if you look at the graph, you're going to see on the y-axis C. difficile colony-forming units per plate. And each colony-forming unit, as you can see in the picture, represents one bacteria that's formed a colony. But where I show you 100, what it means is once there's more than 100 colonies on that auger media, you cannot count them anymore. So the maximum we can actually detect is 100. So you will see that for the white bar, this was the CPD, the Central Processing Department's washer disinfector, and basically the positive control was not put through any process. It was just sampled to show that after drying we could detect all the high levels of spores. If you look at the black bar, this is the Ward washer disinfector for bedpans, and you will see that the negative controls, if we take a bedpan and sample it with the Rodac plates, we don't pick up C. diff. The positive controls show that when we inoculate it, we pick up 100 or more organisms per plate. Now, what's of interest is the far right-hand side of that graph, where with the plastic bedpans, if we put it through the Central Processing Department washer disinfector, the white bar, you'll see there's no detectable C. diff on those bedpans. If we put it through the particular washer disinfector that we were evaluating, a Ward washer disinfector, the black bar, you can see that although it looked visibly clean when it was tested by the Rodac plate, it actually had a huge number of C. diff spores remaining. If we then put that same type of bedpan inoculated in the way I described through the Central Processing Department washer, but only allowed it to have the wash cycle, the thermal wash cycle, and not the dry phase, which is the black and white hatched graph, you can see that we have detectable C. difficile spores. And if we adjusted the Ward bedpan washer up to 85 degrees centigrade for 5 minutes, we still have detectable spores. Now, I put a little note at the bottom just as a reminder. The Central Processing Department washer and disinfector dry cycle is 116 degrees centigrade for 7 minutes. So you can guess what it was that was actually leading to the added punch that was needed to kill the C. difficile spores. And if you go to the next page, what we also did was testing of C. diff in stool in a sealed vial. So we don't have any wash off. We're just asking the question, are the thermal conditions in the bedpan washer sufficient to kill spores in the presence of fecal material and in a way that they don't get diluted or washed off, just in a sealed vial? And again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through this, but what you can see is for the positive control, we can certainly detect many logs of C. difficile. And of course, this is now quantitative because we're actually doing a viable cell count on the suspension. The negative testing shows you that if there's no C. diff in a stool sample put through under the same conditions that has no C. diff in it, the count will be negative. On the other hand, if we put it through the CPD washer and disinfector, which is the white bars, and the cycle has a wash and a dry phase to it, you'll see there's no detectable C. diff spores. It's killed 6 logs of C. diff spores. The Ward washer disinfector, on the other hand, which is basically only a wash cycle, and in this case it was 80 degrees for 1 minute, you can see that we get about a log and a half drop, but not much, and there's still a large number of C. diff spores remaining. If we put the same suspension through the CPD washer and disinfector, but do not allow it to have the dry phase, only the wash cycle, which is the cross-hashed bar or histogram on the right, you can see that it's actually the dry phase that is doing the final punch to kill those spores. Now, if you go to the next slide, I'm not going to walk through all of these, but what I would like you to notice is this is thermal treatment effect on spore killing compared to vegetative organisms. The first panel on the left, which is labeled A, is gram-positive vegetative organisms, and in this case it's Enterococcus faecium. You'll notice the positive control at time zero. We have 8 logs of organisms present in the suspension, and as soon as we hit it with even 1 minute at 80 degrees or 90 degrees, we completely kill all those vegetative organisms. 8 log kill in the time of 1 minute. We tested at 1, 2, and 5 minutes only, so the reason there's no bars on the 3 and the 4 minutes is because we didn't do testing. Same thing occurs for gram negatives, but look at the C. diff spores. You can see that even 5 minutes at 90 degrees does not completely eradicate C. difficile spores. This testing was done in tightly controlled conditions, no fecal material, just spores by themselves in a buffered saline. So what this tells us is that obviously we need some fairly drastic thermal conditions. Not drastic, we need some specific thermal conditions in order to eradicate C. diff spores. In summary, C. diff spores do, in my opinion, form a reservoir for transmission in healthcare facilities. Ourselves and many others have published to show that you have no lack of ability of detecting C. diff spores in the environment of patients with active C. diff-associated diarrhea. The second conclusion or summary point is that bleach definitely does have rapid killing of C. diff spores, but I think the data is not completely solid for the efficacy of its ability to eradicate spores from the ward environment, and there's a lot of workplace safety issues related to the use of it. At a concentration that is not so noxious to work with, it's not very effective at killing C. diff spores. At the concentration, the 5,000 parts per million that's efficient in killing spores, it's a terrible compound to work with because of the fumes that are generated. The third bullet there is accelerated hydrogen peroxide, and we're excited and looking forward to more data related to environmental efficacy of some of these compounds because we've found that it's very formulation dependent, and we're quite hopeful that there will be formulations provided by some of the manufacturers of AHP or even other active ingredients that will be formulated in a way that in a short contact time will facilitate killing C. diff spores. And remember that if you see data where you get good C. diff kill, remember to check. It might be at a concentration where there are some workplace safety issues. Now, from a bedpan washer perspective, there's no doubt that bedpan washers reduce aerosols. They reduce the exposure of healthcare givers to the spores and the other organisms that are present in the fecal material or urine from patients that are on isolation precautions. I think there's a great value in bedpan washers. The question is whether or not the thermal conditions in some of them will actually effectively eradicate the C. diff spores. And you've seen from the data that I presented that the thermal conditions of 80 or 85 degrees for 1 minute are not sufficient to completely eradicate C. diff spores. They still do a good job of cleaning. They're visibly clean. But the C. diff spores can certainly survive those conditions. Now remember, the manufacturers of these bedpan washers are really being completely compliant with the guidelines that are out there. For instance, the ISO 15883-3 recommends 80 degrees at 1 minute for hollowware bedpan washers. And also remember that the manufacturers of bedpan washers do not make any sporicidal claims for their cycle. So I think it's important to recognize that this is not a black lash out at the bedpan washer manufacturers. I think it's a wake-up call for all of us that we really do need to look at our temperature and time conditions for bedpans, and in particular when patients are on isolation precautions. Now remember, just because a patient is known to have C. diff doesn't mean that there are patients out there just prior to when the diagnosis is made that are not on isolation precautions that may be shedding C. diff into these bedpans as well. So we go to the final slide. I would summarize by saying I think C. diff in the healthcare environment is essentially a moving target, as my picture depicts. And I think that some of the best things that we can do in the healthcare is to focus on the religious attention to housekeeping, cleaning, compliance. In other words, we need to make sure that the staff that are doing these jobs recognize the pivotal role they play in ensuring that the environment for the patients that are ill with C. diff-associated diarrhea are treated in a way that ensures that we reduce the risk of spores in their environment, because the physical cleaning part is a huge part of reducing the environmental load. The other thing, I think, is the fecal patrol. I hope I've left you with enough concern from my discussions that you will check on how your bedpans, commodes, and toilets are cleaned and reprocessed. And I hope you don't find some of the nasty surprises that we found when we looked at it and found that, for instance, commodes were in no man's land. So on that note, I would like to stop. I have one other slide in my presentation, but it's simply a list of references. And I would certainly like to acknowledge and recognize the research technologists in my lab that have facilitated the studies that I presented here, Nancy Olson and Alana Wald, both of whom are helping with these studies. So, Paul, on that note, I'm finished, and I hope I've left at least a few minutes for questions.
Well, Michelle, thank you very much. I'll say again that you are one of my favorite teleclass faculty. You continue to impress me with your content and style every time that you give a teleclass. So thank you very much for this very nice close to the teleclass series this year.
On soap and water use versus alcohol hand rubbing, it was mentioned that alcohol hand rubs do not kill the spores, but what exactly is it in soap and water? Is it the mechanical action?
You've asked a very germane question, and yes, the alcohol if you recall, the alcohol-based waterless hand wash systems are aimed at not removing anything physically from your hand. They're just aimed at the alcohol killing the organism. Soap and water, on the other hand, doesn't function that way. It functions more in the process of physically removing or, if you will, solubilizing the organisms that are on your hand and removing the transient organisms. So, yes, it's not that soap and water is actually killing C. diff spores. It certainly does not do that, and you're correct. It's solely based on the physical action. The spores are considered transient colonizers, and under the soap and water, they're basically hydrated and washed off of your hand. So that's how they're working.
Has there been any studies on how many of them, what kind of log reduction we get with a 10-15-second wash?
I'm not aware, anyway, that anyone has actually looked at C. diff spore reduction on people's hands during the washing process. There's been many studies looking at the microbial loads, the vegetative microbes, other organisms, and the reduction that occurs with soap and water. But I think what people are suggesting is use soap and water, because we know that you cannot rely on the alcohol in the alcohol-based system. And so I'm not aware of any data to say, okay, you get a 5-log reduction if you wash your hands with soap and water. That's how much C. diff spore removal will occur.
Dr. Alpha, I'm in a long-term care setting where it's very difficult to isolate our patients or clients because this is their home. And so we really stress the routine practice and to look at risk assessment of people's hygiene and dementia, etc. We can't really isolate per se. Do you have any suggestions for me on how we can handle C. diff in a long-term care setting?
Yeah, I wish I had some golden insights. You definitely face a challenge, and I do appreciate the challenge that's faced. If you have patients there that have clinically significant diarrhea and it's found to truly be C. diff, the issues are identical to the issues in a healthcare setting. And I do understand that the concept of isolation really doesn't quite exist in a long-term care facility, and in particular if you have patients that have some degree of dementia and they're very hard to even, you know, control in terms of where they're moving around, it is a real challenge. But the issues are identical, that you would really need next to the Pope in Rome approach, not just a religious approach, but you would have to have a very stringent approach, I think, to the attention to the handling of the toilet facilities, bedpans, commodes, those types of things. In terms of dealing with long-term care facility, I think the best thing that can be done in that circumstance is as much as possible to try to ensure that the fecal material doesn't get spread all over the place. And obviously what you're doing is the best you can do, but the issues are identical. And in healthcare, what we do is put them on contact precautions and isolation precautions. It's very difficult in long-term care, but the spread issues are identical. So again, ensuring your housekeeping are really doing their job and doing it at least twice a day in the facilities of the toilet facilities of patients with this illness, ensuring the bedpans are not used and properly reprocessed and the commodes and the toilets are dealt with, I think is at least a start.
There's also the issue of the uniforms that the nurses and staff wear all day long when dealing with Clostridium difficile patients and other patients and residents. Those often don't stay at the workplace. They go home, they go to the grocery shop, they go everywhere, and they lean over the produce that I might later buy.
Well, and I didn't touch on it, but of course you and I both know that Guelph has just done a study showing that C. difficile spores can be found in, for instance, hamburger, like ground meat products too. And I don't think that the source of it is from the staff leaning over necessarily the meat counter or something. I think it's coming from an animal source, that we get more of it in our food stream than we recognize. The issue of the uniforms, I think, is one that we know very, very little about, and it is one of the things that we're trying to look into, too, is whether or not the routine laundering actually does either eradicate and or kill spores off of material is a bit of an unknown factor, and it's not just uniforms, it's also the cleaning cloths that are used on a regular basis and reprocessed, too.
And perhaps the dogs and animals that come to visit in the long-term care facilities and get touched and handled by everyone. There's all sorts of things that we can think about there, isn't it? It becomes quite terrifying.
It does, but I think we need to be humane as well, because I think Mary put her finger on it, that in long-term care and some of these other places, these are people's home, and I think we want to take a humane approach to dealing with them, at the same time restricting the risk that other patients or residents are going to have of getting the disease. And with the animals, I think it's the same thing. It's known that they can carry it and transmit it, but the reality is, how big a risk does that play, I think, is still a bit of an unknown factor at this point. But your points are all well taken, Paul.
Well, thanks. I try to make good ones every now and then. I would like to thank the good people at ARJO for their support of this teleclass and of our projects around the world and in developing nations. They do good work. They've certainly been a good support for me, and I appreciate that. A special thanks to all of you for coming along with us today, and a special thanks, again, a very special thanks to Dr. Michelle Alpha for a really outstanding lecture. Michelle, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Folks, until we get a chance to speak again, I wish you all a very happy and safe holiday, and goodbye.